You're listening to a Dwell Community Church production. If you'd like to check out more resources, visit dwellcc.org.
Yeah, so we're going to get into the concept of allegiance. This would be what you're loyal to. Now, for me, one of my biggest loyalties is to Dawn dishwashing liquid. There's a lot of other liquids you can wash dishes with, but don't give me that. I want Dawn. It is better. I mean, I wash a lot of dishes, and it is clearly the superior soap. I would also say the same thing about Tide. You know, I've washed a lot of clothes, and I've got this Downy. You guys ever heard of Downy? It's on. Somebody brought. I don't know how it wound up in my house. I never use it. It's full. I have no interest in that. So, yeah, I don't want to insult anybody, but these are my brand allegiances, I guess. Now, there's something beyond this, a little more serious. It's your highest or your ultimate allegiance. And if you're like, gosh, what would that be for me? You have to think about, what would you suffer to preserve? What would you maybe even be willing to die for? Okay, that when you answer questions like that, then you're moving into, you know, what's ultimately the thing that you want to hitch yourself to, that you're committed to, that you'll never let go of. And, you know, there's a lot of things. You look at these, like the Olympics just started, and you can tell these athletes, their highest allegiance is to win a gold medal. That is the thing they're living for. It could be your family, could be a lot of things. For Daniel in this book, it was his allegiance to the God of Israel. And man, I'll tell you, for him, that was a difficult allegiance to maintain, because he was trying to be loyal to God in an environment where everyone else worshiped other gods. It would be like being in a situation like this. I guess I am implying the Buckeyes are God's team, and I'll just let that slide. But this is what Daniel's life was like every day. Everywhere he went, when he woke up, he was in the minority as a follower of the true God, the God of Israel. And so we've seen already, he's received a lot of pushback for this allegiance, and that'll continue as we move into chapter 5. Now, one thing I want to say right as we start reading is that we've jumped ahead a little bit. Belshazzar, the king, he is several kings down the line from King Nebuchadnezzar, who we've been talking about. So we're jumping ahead a bit from chapter 4 to 5. We've at least a decade or so. Maybe more. The year now is 539 BC. We can precisely date the events in this chapter. This is kind of a chronological anchoring point in the Bible, what we're about to read. So yeah, Belshazzar is now king of Babylon. He holds a great feast for 1,000 nobles, and he was drinking wine in the presence of the 1,000. And it says, when Belshazzar tasted the wine, he gave orders to bring the gold and silver vessels that Nebuchadnezzar, his father, had taken out of the temple, which was in Jerusalem, so that the king and his nobles, his wives and his concubines might drink from them. Okay, that phrase where it says that he tasted the wine, that means he was feeling a little bit of liquid courage. He was starting to get a good buzz going, and he's like, let's get those goblets and chalices and the special vessels from the temple in Jerusalem, and let's use those vessels to drink wine and toast our own gods. So yeah, it says they brought the gold vessels that had been taken out of the temple, the house of God, which was in Jerusalem, and the king and his nobles, his wives and his concubines drank from them. They drank the wine and praised the gods of gold and silver, of bronze and iron and wood and stone. And so, this is kind of like giving God the middle finger, okay? This is so offensive and so deliberately offensive. They're not just praising gods that are no gods, these idols that they have, but they're also using the true God's these vessels from his temple to praise and honor these false gods. And so, that's the opposite of allegiance to God, right? This is what we're looking at, is the exact opposite of what we see in the life of Daniel. And it did not go unnoticed. You know, we live in a world where there is a God, and God is aware of decisions we make and things we see, as things that we say. And so because of that, you know, it's not like God's ignorant of everything that's happening. He very much knows what's going on. And as they toasted these other gods, the true God noted what happened. And it says, suddenly the fingers of a man's hand emerged and began writing opposite the lampstand on the plaster of the wall of the king's palace. And the king saw the back of the hand that did the writing. So you got to put yourself in this situation. It's a big banquet hall. We've actually found a plaster wall like this in this palace, archaeologists. So the idea that there was a space to do something like this, absolutely. And just imagine, you're sitting in a room like this with tons of people, and all of a sudden you see this disembodied hand start writing. You know, suddenly people stop eating. You can hear audible gasps. The servers stop. You know, the music, if there's music playing, the musicians pause. And everyone's like, what? This is an unbelievable thing to be part of. And it says that the king's face grew pale, and his thoughts alarmed him, and his hip joints went slack, and his knees began knocking together. Now, I love the King James version of this. It says the joints of his loins were loosed. That sounds dangerous. That does not sound good at all. Yeah, he was coming undone, obviously, just really wigged out about seeing this. And I mean, who wouldn't be? This is clear evidence that Nebuchadnezzar he's disturbed a power greater than himself. Now, this might be a stretch, but if you're a Lord of the Rings fan, there's a scene in the Mines of Moria in the first movie where Pippin is sitting by a well where there's the skeleton of a dead dwarf, and he knocks the skeleton down this well into the depths of Moria, followed by a chain, followed by a bucket, and everyone's like, oh, man. And then you start to hear tap, 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 knock, 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 coming from deep below. And you're like, oh, what did we just wake up? It was like that, okay? It was that kind of terror that these guys were experiencing. Now, reading this today, I mean, who here has seen a disembodied hand scrawling a message? We don't see this kind of thing very often. We do seem to be seeing quite a bit of like signs and wonders and amazing miracles happening in the book of Daniel. Why is that? I just want to remind you guys, this is written to people that have been in exile in Babylon, Jews who were taken away from Jerusalem, Jews who watched their capital get destroyed, their temple plundered, their children get ripped away from them. People that seriously were concerned after all these setbacks, is our God still in control? And so one thing we see in Daniel is these amazing interventions. And it's because God in his mercy is trying to remind his people, even though they've been so disobedient, stick with me. I'm still in control. I'm still powerful. I'm still able to get you back to the land, and we can get back on this program I have for you. And I just think it's what we're seeing Daniel try to do with the people of Israel. It helps us when we go through adversity, because I've been in stretches where I can think of stretches where I've been leading a group that dwindled down to half its size. Or I've gone through stretches in my marriage where I just feel like, you know, I'm on a treadmill. I'm getting nowhere. We go through these stretches where we do start to wobble in our allegiance to God. We start to wonder, is this the way I should be spending my time? Am I missing the boat? Is there something else I should be connected to that would be better than prioritizing following God? People struggle with this all the time. And what Daniel is doing is so helpful when you're in a stretch like this. He's pointing out to the people. He's like, look at how God has intervened. Look at how God is working. And now, I won't be able to produce a disembodied hand here for you guys, but I'll tell you, in the next few weeks, you're going to see undeniable evidence that the God of history knew the future, knows the future before it's happened, that he and he alone is somebody who has purposes that will be accomplished. If you hang with us for another 2 or 3 weeks, you'll see with your own eyes that's the kind of God that we follow. And I think if we could just talk with each other and reflect on what we've seen already in our own lives, what God's done in our families and our relationships, just with our whole perspective, I think we'll start to be able to stabilize our wobbling allegiance. It's not rocket science. It's going back to what God has done in history and in our lives. That's what Daniel's doing with his audience here. Well, if you keep going, so there's this message on the wall. And Belshazzar offers huge rewards to any wise man who can read the writing. But, of course, none of the Babylonian wise men can do it. They're not sure how to proceed. And so it says, King Belshazzar was greatly alarmed. His face grew even paler because nobody could help. And his nobles were perplexed. And then this woman comes in, the queen. She enters the banquet hall because of the words of the king and his nobles. Now, this queen is not Belshazzar's wife. We've already heard about his wives. They come up in chapter 2, in verse 2, his wives and his concubines. This woman is probably his mom, the queen mother. She's been around a while. And she reminds Belshazzar, she's like, oh, king, love forever. Don't let your thoughts alarm you or your face be pale. There is a man in your kingdom in whom is a spirit of the holy gods. She says, let Daniel be summoned, and he'll declare the interpretation. So Belshazzar's mom remembers that Daniel actually was in touch with the true God and able to interpret dreams. And so they go find Daniel. And you get the sense, when Daniel was brought before the king here, he's retired. I don't know, in some place nearby, but no longer in active service. He was really old, and I don't want to offend anybody, but he was like 80-ish, something like that. Hadn't done this kind of thing in a while. And so they bring him in. And King Belshazzar tells Daniel, I've heard about you, that you're able to give interpretations and solve difficult problems. Now, if you're able to read the inscription and make its interpretation known to me, you'll be clothed with purple and wear a necklace of gold around your neck, and you'll have authority as the third ruler in the kingdom. Okay, so, Babylon's about to fall. So this is a pretty pathetic reward. And it's also a weird reward. Look at that. The third ruler in the kingdom. If Belshazzar is king, why doesn't he offer him the second ruler position in the kingdom? And it's because there's something weird happening here. So for a long time in this part of the Bible, folks that are critical of the Bible thought this was just total BS, that this was a completely fabricated story. And it was because in all of the ancient records we had up until the early 1900s, we had no evidence of Belshazzar. There weren't any clay tablets or cylinders that mentioned him. The Greek historians Herodotus and Xenophon, who wrote about the Babylonians, they don't mention him. The only ancient witness in the world that we had in the early 1900s that claimed Belshazzar was ruling Babylon when it fell is this book, Daniel. And so, yeah, people thought this is just complete nonsense. It must be a forgery written by somebody living hundreds of years after the fact who didn't understand Babylonian history very well. Just nothing out there to support this claim. But then, on January 10th, 1931, this headline hit American newspapers. Excavations in Ur verify the Book of Daniel. Woolley unearths Palace of Belshazzar's sister. And so we got this information from this Leonard Woolley guy, a famous archaeologist. There was a Belshazzar. And then as the tablets and cylinders kept coming in, as they kept excavating this site, not only did they confirm Belshazzar was king in Babylon, but that he indeed was the final king who was ruling Babylon on the night that Babylon fell. It's very cool. What they discovered was that, yes, Nabonidus was king, but his son Belshazzar was co-regent. Nabonidus was out campaigning, military campaigns, but Belshazzar was in the capital city as the co-regent, which is why when he offered Daniel a position of power, he couldn't give him second place. He was like, you can be the third ruler in the kingdom. That's really cool. That should reassure you. We're reading something from somebody who was there for so long. This was the only ancient document we had that had this right. Very faith-building. Now, Daniel's like, okay, let's talk about this reward you're offering. He's like, keep your gifts for yourself or give your reward to someone else. However, I'll read the inscription to the king and make the interpretation known to him. I mean, this would seriously, like, you get to be king of the sandcastle right before the tide comes in, right? This is just, this is a worthless offer. And not only that, Daniel's surveying what's happening in this banquet hall. He's looking at all these goblets filled with wine. He's looking at the utter offense to God. And he's like, you know what? I can't ally with you in ruling anything. And so the king gets, instead of Daniel receiving this thing, Daniel tells him why his empire is about to end. Okay, Daniel says, O King Most High, the Most High God granted sovereignty, grandeur, glory, and majesty to Nebuchadnezzar, your father. Because of the grandeur with which he bestowed on him, all the peoples, nations, and men of every language feared and trembled before him. Okay, we've read about this already. Nebuchadnezzar was the greatest king of his time. We saw how he became a super powerful monarch who did a lot of building. And this was, it says father, that word in Aramaic can mean grandfather, great-grandfather. It's more like ancestor. And so he goes on, he says, but when Nebuchadnezzar's heart was lifted up and his spirit became so proud that he behaved arrogantly, he was deposed from his royal throne and his glory was taken away from him. And here's the thing. Belshazzar knew about this. Belshazzar knew that his grandfather was super proud. He knew that he had gotten full of himself and that God had intervened to humble him by turning him into a wild animal until he had the humility to go, God, you're in charge. Belshazzar knew all of that. And then here Daniel says, yet you, his son Belshazzar, have not humbled your heart, even though you knew this, but you've exalted yourself against the Lord of heaven, and they've brought the vessels of his house before you, and you and your nobles, your wives, and your concubines have been drinking wine from them. He's like, if anyone should know better, you should know, because you know the story, you know what God thinks of pride. And yet you did this completely disrespectful thing. You praise the gods of silver and gold, bronze, iron, wood, and stone, which don't see, hear, or understand, but the God in whose hand are your life breath and all your ways you have not glorified. Then the hand was sent from him, and this inscription was written out. And he says, yeah, you know, your worst fears are confirmed. You have offended the true God, and that's his hand writing out this message to you, because he's offended by your behavior. And so, yeah, why the writing on the wall? Why is it even there? It's to get his attention, to get Belshazzar's attention. It's not a positive message. It's here's a guy that led 1,000 people into this completely defiant insult against God and exalted himself against God. God's intervening to send this guy a message. And so here's the interpretation. This is the inscription that was written out. Mene, mene, tekel, upharsin. I don't know if that's how you say it, but this is the interpretation of the message. Mene, God has numbered your kingdom and put an end to it. Tekel, you've been weighed on the scales and found deficient. Peres, your kingdom has been divided and given over to the Medes and the Persians. It's not hard to understand. This is it for Babylon. Babylon is doomed. Belshazzar will no longer be the king of anything. His empire has ended. And so when we talked a couple weeks ago about that statue vision and you had the head of gold as Babylon, and then the implication was it would be replaced by the chest and arms of silver, Medo-Persia, that's what we're reading about here. The Medes and Persians are going to replace Babylon as the reigning empire. In fact, as Belshazzar was hearing this interpretation, soldiers from the Medes and Persians were sneaking into the city of Babylon. I mean, literally as this was happening. And so Belshazzar, a tough message, but apparently he received it because he gave orders and they clothed Daniel with purple and put a necklace of gold around his neck and issued a proclamation. They must have forced Daniel to do this. And they issued a proclamation concerning Daniel that he now had authority as the third ruler in the kingdom. And so we know he didn't want it. Probably just sat there while they forced him to put this stuff on. And as this was happening, these guys, the Medes and Persians, were making their way into the city of Babylon. And we know this. This is something else we know from sources outside the Bible. Upstream, so there was a river that ran through the walls of Babylon, which are like 100 feet high, the Euphrates River. And so upstream, they diverted the water in the Euphrates River into a swamp. And the water level of the river lowered. And then soldiers from the Medes and Persians waded in that low water underneath the walls and started to enter the city in huge numbers. This is, we know from Xenophon, that when they showed up in the city, they found many asleep, many drunk, and none in battle array. And we know that as they entered the palace, as they got close and started to enter into this banquet hall, they were dealing, the Medo-Persian soldiers were dealing blows right and left, kind of fighting their way into the palace. They came into the presence of the king, and they found him already risen with his dagger in his hand, and they avenged themselves upon the wicked king. And so this is the night that Belshazzar died, right as his empire ended. And that's what we read in Daniel. That same night, Belshazzar, the Chaldean king, was slain. And Darius the Mede received the kingdom at the age of 62. And I just want to throw that out there. This is not in a galaxy far, far away. This is not a fairy tale. These events happened. They actually happened. We have good evidence that they actually happened. And I hope that builds your faith as we go through this. Whoever wrote this book, Daniel wrote this book, lived through these experiences. You know, and the other thing I think when we think about allegiance that we should consider here is this is a classic example of misplaced allegiance. Belshazzar put his chips on the wrong square. He hitched his wagon to the wrong thing. He should have, you know, you think he had all the evidence he needed to know that the true God was the one solid thing that people in his family had come in contact with. But in his own pride, he hitched his wagon to himself and to his own empire. And that was a dumb mistake. based on what he knew. And so it's just a reminder. There's so many things you can say, this is where I plant my flag. Man, pick your allegiances carefully. Because if it's not God, you know, you think, what is the one stable thing in our life? Something that'll take us beyond the grave. Someone that knows us, loves us, and that we can always count on. There's only one answer. It's God. Plant your flag somewhere else. And it's not going to go well. That's one big lesson from this. Well, there's a new power in town, the Medo-Persians, their king Darius. Now that he's got this enormous empire, the new empire that these guys are running is now even bigger than the Empire of Babylon. It seemed good to Darius to appoint 120 satraps over the kingdom, that they would be in charge of the whole kingdom, and over them three commissioners, of whom Daniel was one, that these satraps might be accountable to them and that the king might not suffer loss. Okay, this idea that there's money coming in, tax revenue, lots of money, means corruption's a possibility. And so all of this hierarchical structure is set up to basically protect the tax revenue. And Daniel is given a very key role in that. He, it says, began distinguishing himself among the commissioners and satraps because he possessed an extraordinary spirit, and the king planned to appoint him over the whole kingdom. Okay, so a man of integrity, right? Here's a guy that can be trusted. Here's a guy who, because his allegiance is to the true God, is going to handle all that revenue well. Darius recognizes that. He recognizes this guy is the best person I have. This is the best public servant in this empire. And Darius decides, I've got to even elevate Daniel further, which, if you're one of his co-commissioners, did not go over well. I mean, can you imagine hearing that one of your co-workers, you're sitting in a cubicle next to him or whatever, all of a sudden you show up at work the next day and they've been promoted two levels above you, right? And your coworker is now your boss's boss. That'd be pretty hard to take, right? Did not go over well. And when word got out that Daniel would soon be appointed over the whole kingdom, the commissioners and satraps began trying to find a ground of accusation against Daniel in regard to government affairs. Of course, they couldn't find one or even evidence of corruption in as much as he was faithful. And they realize it's tied to his allegiance to his God. He's not going to be doing anything that's selfish or taking for himself. And so no negligence or corruption was to be found in him. They couldn't pin anything on him. And so you can see they're just like, what are we going to do to take this guy out? There's just nothing we can bust him on. There's no way we can expose him. And then they said, will we not find any ground of accusation against Daniel? We will not find any ground of accusation against him unless we find it against him with regard to the law of his God. And you can imagine, this is a collaboration. There are multiple people involved, multiple enemies Daniel had. And they have kind of an aha moment. They're like, it's his faith in God. That's how we can get him. His allegiance to God is greater than his loyalty to the king. There's got to be a way we can nail him on that. And so once it hits them that is a possible way forward, they decide this is an area of vulnerability. We have to craft a law to make it illegal for Daniel to be carrying out his allegiance to God. And so these commissioners and satraps came by agreement to the king. They spoke to him as follows. King Darius, live forever. All the commissioners of the kingdom, the prefects, the satraps, the high officials, you know, everybody that's anybody, we've consulted together. It shows you how hostile this environment. Talk about a tough workplace environment. You know, he's walking down the hall. People are like, hello, Mr. Commissioner. And they're kind of looking at him, and Daniel's looking at, you know, you can just sense the tension here. All the commissioners, everybody that's anybody, have consulted together that the king should establish a statute and enforce an injunction that anyone who makes a petition to any god or man besides you, O king, for 30 days shall be cast into the lion's den. And you read that right. Darius was viewed as a god. And so as a dude who is running a new empire, who has to find some way to unify everyone, these politicians come in and they're like, let's pass a law, doesn't have to go for a long time, where everybody in this whole empire has to come together for a month and only worship and pray to you. And so, interesting plan, clear idea. It's the kind of thing, they know Daniel's going to keep praying to his God no matter what. They know if they can get this law through, they'll be able to bust Daniel. But how do you persuade Darius to approve? Now, this is interesting. I read up on this a little bit. See that phrase, came by agreement? That's a single word. It literally means to come to somebody in a throng or a surge of people. It's like an ancient flash mob, kind of. So one person comes into the king and knows that someone else is there that they've already talked to. And one person says, hey, to unify the empire, why don't we make everyone worship you? And someone else is like, oh, that's a great idea. And then out of nowhere, somebody else comes in the room and says, I heard what you guys were saying. That is a great idea. And pretty soon, there's like 6 or 7 people in the room, and their voices are getting louder, and they're like, let's do this. We need to get this empire rallied around you, king. We should pass this. For 30 days, it's illegal to pray to anybody but you. Something like that, a surge of people bringing him to the point where he would go ahead and decide. And so right as they've got, you know, the fever pitch build up, it says they appeal to him, establish an injunction and sign a document so that it might not be changed according to the law of Medes and Persians, this law that only you are only allowed to pray to Darius. And notice, too, it says this law, once he signs it, can't be revoked. And so he did. There was some kind of social pressure here, and Darius signed the document and made it illegal to pray to anybody but him. And, you know, what's interesting about this is we know from Persian history that unlike the Babylonian kings, who were total autocrats that could do whatever they wanted, in Medo-Persia, if the king passed a law, the king was subject to his own laws. He had to follow through with it. And so you're Daniel. What do you do when your allegiance to God is counter to the law or to your social circle or to cultural norms? What do you do at this point? I remember when I was a young Christian, I was at McDonald's with a buddy in high school, and he pulled his Bible out in McDonald's, where all my friends used to go. And I'm like, what are you doing with the Bible out? And I remember looking, and people, you know how they kind of look at you and look at the Bible and then just, you know, kind of tilt their head. It was the first time in my life I was in a situation where I could tell my decision to get into God was going to have some ramifications, right? And so here's Daniel. Obviously, these are much more severe. What do you do when you know that persisting in your allegiance to God is going to cost you something? Here's what Daniel did. When he knew that the document was signed, he entered his house. Now, in his roof chamber, he had windows open toward Jerusalem, and he continued kneeling on his knees 3 times a day, praying and giving thanks before his God, as he had been doing previously. He very openly and very deliberately kept doing what he had always done. There was no protest. He didn't, like, get on Facebook and light people up about how unjust this law was. All he did was openly and unapologetically continue to pray. And he did it with his windows open. He wanted people to know that he was going to persist in his allegiance to God, and he was not trying to hide it whatsoever. And I just wonder, How are you doing with that? You know, in a work setting or in your neighborhood or at school or even, you know, in a big family gathering. Do you feel this sense I need to dial myself down and keep what I'm into on the down low? And you find it difficult in situations like that to, you know, to go ahead and just be the Christian that you are because you know there's a cost associated with that. Are you keeping your windows open, so to speak? That's a good question to ask yourself. You know, I know you guys know, how does this story, where are we headed next? He's gonna get caught, and then he's gonna be thrown in a lion's den. And a lot of people, when they read this story, they think that's where Daniel overcame his fears. That's where the battle was won, in the lion's den. And I submit that's not where the battle was won. The battle was won on his knees before God in that rooftop with the windows open as he talked to God and thanked God and offered his whole future to God and just put himself in God's hands. That's where the battle was won, long before he ever got thrown in the lion's den. And I would just say, you know, if you're wrestling with this, we all wrestle with the fear of ostracism, the fear of rejection, the fear of maybe other more severe consequences. This is something Christians have wrestled with forever. And here's Paul talking about it. He says, when I think of the suffering I go through, he's like, I suffer these things, but I'm not ashamed. For I know whom I've believed, and I'm convinced that he's able to guard what I've entrusted to him until that day. And so, yeah, he's just like, I know that there's a cost, but I also know God can, he's got my back, and that trusting him is going to be worth it. And so, yeah, I just wonder, you know, if you're going to go into a situation where you know there's going to be this temptation to kind of dial down who you really are, the battle begins by just praying to God and entrusting yourself to him, just like we see Daniel doing. That's where the strength comes from, to walk into these situations and still have our allegiance to God. Well, it says these men came by agreement, and they found Daniel making petition and supplication before God. So apparently they were like outside of his house watching him pray so that they could have multiple eyewitnesses. And then they answered and spoke before the king, and they said, Daniel is one of the exiles from Judah. He's not paying attention to you, O king, or to the injunction which you signed, but he keeps making his petition. We caught somebody breaking the law that you just passed. And then it says, as soon as the king heard the statement, he was deeply distressed. And he set his mind on delivering Daniel. And even until sunset, he kept exerting himself to rescue him. Now, this is very different than Nebuchadnezzar, super different. Nebuchadnezzar, if this would have happened to him, he would have hit the ceiling and cut somebody's head off. But Darius is very reflective. He instantly realizes he's made a terrible mistake. He's jeopardizing the life of his best public servant. And from this moment, he starts, I don't know if he's like going down to the law library, trying to figure out, is there a way we can undo this mistake I've made? But from that moment, he's trying to figure out how to not go through with this execution. That's noticed by these satraps, prefects, commissioners. These guys come by agreement and they're like, hey, recognize that it's a law of the Medes and Persians that no injunction or statute which the king establishes may be changed. They're like, don't you dare try to back off on this law that you've passed. And again, we know from sources outside the Bible that is how the Persians operated. Kings of Medes and Persians, they were subject to their own laws. And so the king gave orders. He didn't want to do it. And Daniel was brought in and cast into the lion's den. The king spoke and said to Daniel, your God whom you constantly serve will himself deliver you. And so it's almost like a feeble prayer. And in fact, in some translations, it says, may your God whom you constantly serve deliver you. And then a stone. Interesting. A stone was brought and laid over the mouth of the den. And the king sealed it with his own signet ring and with the signet rings of his nobles so that nothing would be changed in regard to Daniel. And so, you know, imagine being Darius walking back, thinking about what he's just done, thinking about how dumb it is, how he's about to lose the best guy he has. It says he went off to his palace and spent the night fasting. And no entertainment was brought before him, and his sleep fled from him. And what we have an example here of is when your allegiance to God can be so striking that people around you watching you can't stop thinking about it. Ever been around somebody whose convictions were so deep it just strikes you? Daniel's commitment to God made Darius search his own soul. He wasn't like watching Netflix or scrolling through Facebook. He was, all he could do is think about Daniel and the way Daniel lived and what he was doing. And I just wonder, when you think about this, is your life the Christianity people see you living out? Is it striking? Is it striking to people enough that they might question their assumptions? You know, I remember as my first exposure to a Christian, the first Christian man I ever met was very sincere. My family members used to like kind of talk bad about him when he wasn't around, kind of thought he was just kind of a fool. But I got around this guy because his son was my best friend. And this guy, I could tell, he was living his Christianity with his windows open. He was an enthusiastic, passionate lover of Jesus Christ. Talked about it openly with my family, with me. And I remember it took me a while to warm up to him, but I was deeply struck by being around this guy. I became a Christian in the back seat of his station wagon because of the way he lived. And there is something striking about a winsome, loving believer who is openly putting God first. And that's part of what we're seeing here. This is the power of this kind of allegiance. Well, it says the king arose at dawn at the break of day, and he went in haste to the lion's den. And when he came near the den to Daniel, he cried out with a troubled voice. The king spoke and said to Daniel, "Daniel, servant of the living God, has your God, whom you constantly serve, been able to deliver you from the lions?" And Daniel's like, no thanks to you, buddy. Now, with the same kind of respectful, you know, approach that he's taken all the way through this book, he spoke to the king. He said, "O king, live forever. My God sent his angel and shut the lions' mouths, and they have not harmed me." And so, yeah, the lions take a break. Somehow he winds up not getting eaten alive like almost everybody gets eaten. And so this is a cool ending, right? He doesn't get eaten, but it doesn't always go that way. Later in Hebrews, the author of Hebrews reflects on situations like this. Check this out. He talks about people like Daniel, people of faith, who through faith conquered kingdoms, administered justice, and gained what was promised, who shut the mouths of lions. But he also talks about others who were tortured, faced jeers and flogging, and even chains and imprisonment, who were put to death by stoning, sawed in two. Men of whom, I love this, men of whom the world was not worthy. And so, allegiance to God, if the finish line is death, doesn't make a lot of sense in many cases. But there's more to life than when we die. There's a whole new life after that. A life that these people were looking forward to as they offered themselves to serve God despite the consequences. And so, I just would say there's not going to be physical deliverance every time, but your choice to put your allegiance in God is going to have a lasting impact. It really is. It has on me, and I'm sure it has on many of you as well. Well, the king was pleased. He gave orders for Daniel to be taken up out of the den. So Daniel was taken up, And no injury whatever was found on him because he had trusted in his God. The king then gave orders, and they brought those men who had maliciously accused Daniel, and they cast them, their children, and their wives into the lion's den. And they had not reached the bottom of the den before the lions overpowered them and crushed all their bones. Ooh. That's rough. That is really rough. Now, just really quickly, obviously, God, this isn't what God wants. It's not what Daniel wanted. This is a pagan king doing something horrible. The Bible doesn't endorse everything that it describes. It's certainly not endorsing this. This is just what people do that are far from God. And so Darius says, I make a decree that in all the dominion of my kingdom, men are to fear and tremble before the God of Daniel, for he is the living God and enduring forever, and his kingdom is one which won't be destroyed, and his dominion will be forever. So like Nebuchadnezzar, Darius has a moment of clarity. He still says it's Daniel's God. I don't think he believed in God. But if you're a Jew in exile hearing this kind of imperial proclamation go out, and you're struggling with, do I have the right loyalties? Is God still in control? Hearing this would be super fortifying. Okay, and so that's how chapter 6 pretty much winds up. I wanted to finish with just a couple thoughts. One thought is, if you think about the whole Bible, Daniel's not the only person who was ganged up on by his enemies or arrested while praying or jailed over unjust charges. Daniel's not the only person whose calm integrity and conviction left the authorities above him deeply troubled. And he's not the only one who was sealed behind a stone and left for dead. I know that there's no statement from a New Testament author about a connection between Daniel and Jesus, but Jesus in many ways did and acted just like we see Daniel acting. He was willing to go all the way, even if it cost him his life, and it did in his case, and yet none of that kept God's work from advancing. If you know the story about Jesus, he did die. And he was sealed in a grave behind a stone. But 3 days later, he rose again. He rose again, giving us hope that no matter what we face in our allegiance to God, it's going to be okay. This is Paul. This is because of what happened to Jesus, Paul's able to say this on death row. Paul said, the Lord will rescue me from every evil deed and will bring me safely to his heavenly kingdom. To him be the glory forever and ever. Man, so that is so cool. Nothing can take this away from you. So the idea of have you ever just sat down as you're wrestling with your fears and just told Jesus, I believe this. I believe that you did rise again. And I believe because of that, I have eternal life. And that's something that's accessible to anybody. Have you ever just told the Lord, I believe your son rose, and I want what he offers. I want that eternal life. And I just would encourage you to go to God and work it out. And if you already know Christ, go to God and re-remind yourself, this is where I'm headed because Jesus rose again. And if in doing this you're like, well, what if I realize my allegiance is ultimately to myself? Join the club, right? This is something we all struggle with. This is a really hard thing. And the only way to break free is, like we talked about last week, to just have an expanding view of how awesome God is. You can admit to Jesus, how about this? This is what Peter said to Jesus when a lot of his disciples, Jesus' followers, were walking away. He said, only you, Jesus, have the words of eternal life. That is the only solid thing we have to stand on, ultimately, is our relationship with Jesus Christ. He alone can offer eternal life. And so that's a thought. And here's one final thought. Daniel was, what did I say, is about 80. Still high character, still true to God, still looking to serve and help wherever he could. Man, he finished well. You don't see that very often. And I think a lot of us, we feel like, I'm hanging up my cleats. I put in my time. There's not much left for me to do as I enter this stage of life. But I mean, for me, honestly, watching people a couple decades ahead of me still going for it, still pursuing character change, still trying to serve people, it's powerful. It's a powerful example. It may be one of our biggest legacies to try to imitate Daniel in finishing well the way he did. So, okay, there you go. That's it. Yeah, God, I do thank you that we got some warmer days ahead. And I also thank you, Lord, that we got some amazing stuff in this book to get into over the coming weeks. And just help me hang in there with this and help everybody keep coming out to just see your glory through some of these amazing passages that we're about to get into in coming weeks. Amen.